You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners. This will be our last episode before we take a summer break, and we thought we'd celebrate reaching 200,000 listens with a summer greatest hits playlist of our most popular episodes of 2019 so far. So if any of you wish to keep your grey matter ticking over during the heatwave whilst lying by the pool, what follows is a series of brief descriptions of and excerpts from our selection of podcasts. We hope you enjoy it, and we wish you all a relaxing summer break. First on the list are our two most recent episodes, 88 and 89. My co-presenter, Emma Louise Fenelon, attended the Administrative Law Bar Conference last week and recorded a sparky response to Jonathan Sumption's 2019 Wreath Lectures. On the panel were Lord Dyson, Sir Stephen Laws, Professor Vernon Bogdanor, Professor Meg Russell, and Lord Faulkner, chaired by Mrs. Justice Thornton. This episode is followed by a conversation between Lord Sumption and Lord Justice Singh, responding to the panel. Here is a brief clip from that episode.
My concern about the Human Rights Act, and I agree that Parliament either did or should have done this with its eyes open, is that I think that there is a problem about passing an essentially legislative power to a body that stands outside the constitutional framework of the United Kingdom and is therefore not amenable to any kind of democratic input. That is the point that I was seeking to make.
That's the Strasbourg Court.
That's the Strasbourg Court. Now, some of those considerations would also apply to the institutions of the European Union. But the position is completely different in the case of the European Union. Essentially, the European Union is a process of pooling sovereignty, which does have the effect of removing decision-making to a higher level and a more remote level, but it is nevertheless a collective process in which there is input. People may differ about how valuable the European Parliament is for that purpose, but there is input from each of the member countries. It's not conceptually that different from the basis on which the 13 provinces of the United States came together to form the United States in 1787. But the creation of a judicially enforced code of law, which is what the Human Rights Convention is, which is applied in a creative and developing fashion by a court which, as a court, is not amenable to any kind of democratic input, I think creates altogether more fundamental problems.
Next, we have Emma's conversation with Robert Keller, QC, in episode 70. They discuss the development of the law about consent and causation in medical litigation since the groundbreaking decision in Chester and Afshar. In that case, the House of Lords was split on the question of causation, including the important factor of the patient's self-determination.
The court conceived personal autonomy as a fundamental human right. It was what made it possible to live a meaningful life as an individual. It was so important that they felt that it needed to be given effective protection wherever possible, even if that meant a departure from conventional principles on causation. So that was factor number one. The second factor was that the injury that was suffered by poor Miss Chester was within the scope of the duty to warn. The injury was cowder equina. That was the very thing that Miss Chester should have been warned about. It wasn't some completely unrelated risk that eventuated for her. And so because of those two factors, breach of the right to autonomy and the injury being within the scope of the duty to warn, the majority felt that a departure from the conventional test on causation was merited.
In simple terms, what does this mean for the law of causation?
Well, certainly at the time of the decision itself, it's not entirely clear. I mean, my own thesis on reading the decision back is that the House of Lords felt that they were doing something quite dramatic and groundbreaking. There's a huge emphasis in the decision on the right to autonomy, a huge emphasis on the importance of granting a remedy where that right had not been respected, where it had been breached, so to speak. My own personal view, and it's a personal view, is that their lordships felt that they were making it easier to get home, on causation at least, where informed consent had not been properly performed, where personal autonomy had not been properly respected.
Breach of duty in informed consent cases has proved a popular subject on LawPod UK, as we found when we interviewed James Badenoch QC on the Doctor Knows Best rule of evidence. You'll find James talking to me, Rosalind English, in episode 60. If you haven't heard it, it's best to listen to that edition before John Whitting's interview on informed consent. Here's James on the standard of care that used to apply to doctors, and the following clip is from my interview with John Whitting QC in episode 64.
What the judge essentially said was that in the medical profession there's room for many perfectly valid differences of opinion, and that in a given case where negligence by a doctor was alleged, it was not enough for a judge to prefer the evidence of the plaintiff, as we then called them, to the evidence given on behalf of the defendant. If there was at least a respectable body of reasonable medical opinion that would sanction or approve what was done or was not done, there was no room, said the judge to the jury, for them to find negligence. With the consequence, of course, that the standard of care was being set by doctors for doctors, essentially, and not by judges or courts of law imposing it on doctors. Very different, has already been said, from all other walks of life. When that case was followed in a leading case called Maynard against the West Midlands, the same principle was strongly endorsed by the Court of Appeal, including Lord Scarman, and the Times published a law report of the case of Maynard with the heading, "No Negligence Where Doctors Disagree." Now, imagine applying that principle to any other area of negligence, whether it be the negligent factory owner who allows his machine to cut off the hand of a worker, or even, let's take it simply, a driving case. Would it be enough to ride the defendant out that somebody was prepared to stand up and say, well, I'm a driver or I'm a factory owner and I think that was perfectly all right? The application of Bolam in its strictest sense, therefore, effectively disqualified a judge from performing the proper judicial function, which is, as we all know, to listen to the evidence, to decide which side of a disputed case the evidence he prefers, and to give judgment accordingly.
Do you feel that there's a slightly, let's say, unrealistic or ivory tower approach in the appellate courts to these questions of consent when you actually think of the pressures and the stresses of a real hospital setting?
I think that's a very real problem, and I spend my life discussing this with my clients, and I do a lot of defendant work, and so I spend a lot of time with obstetricians, with fetal-maternal medicine experts, with neurosurgeons, and all manner of medical practitioners. You have to face this challenge every day. And the message I have received loud and clear over the last few years since Montgomery was decided is that they feel that it is putting them in an invidious position. And they are terrified to advise their patients in the way in which they think they are competent to do, because there will be many situations, and Montgomery factually is one of those situations, where there is a relatively straightforward concept for the patient to understand, and which, where there are a series or some alternative options that the patient can take, and it's entirely understandable that in those circumstances, particularly in the context of an antenatal clinic where you've got time to plan ahead for the future, where the sort of discussion that's contemplated by the Supreme Court can take place. But there are many, many other circumstances where that is, I think, unrealistic. And that is certainly the opinion of many of my clients. And I think in perhaps two discrete ways. One is in the more dynamic setting where there is an urgency about the decisions that have to be taken, where you're not sitting calmly over a cup of tea discussing what you're going to do in a few months' time. you're discussing and contemplating what has to be done right now. Otherwise, somebody's life may be lost or they may suffer a very serious injury. And the second, I think, discrete area is where there is a juxtaposition or a tension between what specific Royal College or NICE guidance is telling the clinician should be done in a specific circumstance and the offering of a suite or a menu of alternatives to a patient.
Not all of our interviews concern the nitty-gritty of black letter law. Shortly before the film about the US Supreme Court Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg arrived in the UK, Emma detained busy High Court Judge Philippa Whipple to reflect upon the challenges facing women at all levels of the legal profession. Here's a clip from episode 61.
She's often spoken of her going to Harvard, Harvard Law School, and finding herself to be one of only 9 women in a class of 500. She's spoken about how she felt herself to be on display as a woman and that she felt she had to succeed not just for herself, but so that she didn't let other women down. Her time at Harvard Law School really was extraordinary. She'd met her husband, Marty Ginsburg, at school in Cornell, and they'd married at the end of their time at Cornell. But by the time she enrolled at Harvard Law School a year or two later, she had a baby daughter. This is Jane, who is now an eminent law professor in her own right. Ruth's husband, Marty, was also at Harvard Law School in the year above. But soon after she arrived, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. So we have a picture during this time of Ruth, who looked after the baby, looked after her husband, read her husband's syllabus to be able to tell him what he needed to know to progress his studies, and then she undertook her own work, which was last in the pecking order. She speaks of having routinely had only 2 hours sleep at about that time, and she's still known, even now, as someone who manages on very little sleep.
Sleepless nights may be part and parcel of the life of the diligent law trainee, but what about the vulnerabilities of students generally? Marina Wheeler QC talked to us about the government's Prevent programme to restrict the access of extremists to campus to stop them radicalising students. But this project was challenged in court by a British Muslim who argued that his right to free speech was being infringed.
Dr. Butt is a British Muslim, a biochemist by training, who writes for and edits a website called Islam 21st Century. He's also someone who has taken part in discussions and speeches at universities, usually invited by the University Islamic Society. The views that he's expressed, which have caused concern, involve equating homosexuality with paedophilia, defending gender segregation, and also claiming that criticism of segregation and female genital mutilation amounts to an attack on Islam. So what happened with Dr. Butt was that the Extremism Analysis Unit, which is a body set up by government to advise on extremism, this unit had identified him, among others, as a speaker who was professing opposition to core British values and in relation to which some concerns had been raised. And what happened was that Downing Street, in the context of issuing a press statement about extremism on campuses, mentioned Dr. Butt by name. So in response to the press release, he brought a number of complaints and legal actions. One of those is a defamation case and a case about data protection, which is not at issue here. But the case that was looked at last year and has recently come back to the Court of Appeal focused on the guidance itself and also Dr. Butt's own convention rights, specifically his privacy rights, but also free speech rights as well.
If you don't know how that claim played out in the courts, listen to Emma Louise Fenelon talking to Marina in episode 75. As podcasters, we at LawPod UK came late to the table of legal journalism, so we thought we'd interview Fleet Street law legend Francis Gibb. I asked Frances about the huge changes to law journalism since she started as a columnist nearly 40 years ago.
at that time, it was a very, very closed world in that PR for the legal profession didn't really exist in the way it exists now. And when I was appointed, I had to hunt out the chairman of the bar and come and find him in his chambers and, you know, arrange to have a coffee. And that was all rather kind of archaic. And the judiciary, likewise, Lord Lane, who was Lord Chief Justice at that time, we never gave interviews on principle. So there was no contact between the top judiciary and the media. But it did change after Lord Lane left, not just because of him, but that was one part of the slow change that was going on. And what we got then were the beginnings of openness in that the judiciary gave press conferences and they started. Lord Taylor of Gosforth, whose time was sadly cut short because he died, but he actually went on BBC Question Time, which was quite a remarkable thing at that time. So judiciary started to give press conferences. The professional bodies of the Bar and the Law Society and similar all had their own press offices. The judiciary had their own press offices. This all kind of developed over time, but it made a huge difference. And it developed as an area where there was a kind of two-way process. You know, we were after the stories and they were wanting to give us stories of a kind. I mean, you know, their own things, obviously. But yes, that was a big change.
But I wonder whether it's slightly two-edged sword, because since they became media savvy and they were in charge of the stories, did that make it more difficult for investigative journalists and editors in your position to get to the nub of things?
Yes, it was a two-edged sword, because whereas you could get the more routine stuff, so if somebody was making a judge or a senior legal politician was making a speech, that would all be much easier. You could get hold of it. There were channels to go through. But against that, and this is again over time, Whitehall in particular developed quite a controlling influence over how stories emerged. And I can remember that in the 80s, I would quite often have lunches or drinks with senior officials and particularly the permanent secretaries in what was then called the Lord Chancellor's Department. And that was extremely useful, obviously, because they would chat and give you gossip and say, we're thinking of bringing forward proposals on X or Y. But of course, that all stopped. I mean, it really stopped with a vengeance, I think, finally, under Tony Blair's government, where all the control then came from Number 10 and Downing Street and then was continued by David Cameron. So you don't have that sort of access. I mean, I can't remember the last time I had a lunch with a permanent secretary.
Talking about changes, a number of barristers from One Crown Office Row were delighted by a recent U-turn in government policy. They represented various environmental groups in the Newport Bypass Planning Inquiry, in which their objections were rejected by the inspector in his final report. But much to everyone's surprise, the First Minister of Wales chose to override that decision, and he turned down that major infrastructure project on environmental grounds. I talked to Alistair Henderson in episode 85, who was predictably delighted by the result.
It's fantastic for a couple of reasons. I think it's probably one of the biggest environmental success stories in terms of challenging a major infrastructure project on environmental grounds that there's been in the UK. But it's also a welcome surprise, because after a lengthy and quite exhaustive public inquiry, the planning inspector, Mr. Wardrop, who I think sadly has now died, but he produced his report last year, and he actually recommended that the Black Route should go ahead. So we had huge involvement. I was representing this group of objectors in the planning inquiry, and we felt like we hadn't got anywhere. But actually, we did, I think, manage to significantly influence the key decision maker, which was the First Minister himself, and he's taken that decision, which is great.
There's obviously been strong opposition to this decision, and I noticed that the report at the beginning quotes the general pro motorway extension, saying that the M4 congestion was, quotes, a foot on the windpipe of the Welsh economy.
Yes, that's quite graphic, but it's... Well, to be honest, I don't think there's any real disagreement about the fact that the M4 in South Wales, and particularly around this part, going through Newport, is very congested and that is causing real problems. The traffic is very bad at times and it's been bad for some time. We had all sorts of data about that in the course of the inquiry. The real question, though, is what to do about it. And I think the fundamental disagreement between those who were pursuing this scheme and the Welsh Government, who had been promoting it, and a whole range of objectors, which included the environmental groups that we were acting for, but also, interestingly, quite a lot of small business owners and quite a lot of local people, was not to do with whether or not there's traffic problems, but whether or not this scheme was the way to deal with it. Basically, whether building a new motorway, a bigger and better motorway, was a sensible way to deal with the problem, or whether there were actually much better ways of dealing with it. The two proposals that were, the alternative proposals that were put, one was something called the Blue Route, which was a much less invasive form of change to the motorway layout. But the third option was to say, well, actually, we should be looking at much more sustainable transport. We should be looking at putting lots more investment into public transport, into encouraging cycling and walking, and much more sustainable ways of boosting the economy. And that argument, I think, has carried the day, which is great news.
We'll see how much of a watershed this decision comes to be as other public authorities balance the needs of the economy against the environment. LawPod UK reaches out to places beyond England and Wales, geographically and in time. Earlier this year, I was able to persuade Cape Town Labour judge Anton Steenkamp to talk to me about the challenges of upholding the rule of law in a country where people are plenty and employment is scarce. In his chambers in downtown Cape Town, I would not have known that I was the last person ever to interview him. I've read in some of the cases, certainly, that on which you've given judgments, including the quite famous case that hit the international press, the case involving Robertson Winery and the strikes by the agricultural workers there, that not only were retaliations against replacement workers, but there was actual hate speech that rendered the actions of the strikers unlawful. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, that's quite interesting. Because in that case, the court granted an order, my colleague Edwin Tlotlamache granted an order restraining the union and its members from intimidating, harassing and threatening any employees or temporary labour, and in interdicting them from preventing access to vehicles and to people going in and out, and from carrying weapons. So one of the interesting and unusual aspects of that case was, although workers generally in South Africa, when they picket, they will sing and dance and what we call toi toi, which is a revolutionary dance. And in fact, the picketing rules, default picketing rules, issued by the minister and normally implemented by the CCMA, specifically make provision for it that is allowed. In this case, the strikers went a bit further. They chanted a song containing the words Dubula Renet. Translated into English, that translates to shoot Renet. And they were referring to one Renet Jordan, which was the winery's human resources manager.
So they were calling for a specific act of violence against a named person.
Exactly. And of course, that might sound shocking at first glance. The counsel for the union was arguing that it should be seen in the context of struggle songs dating back to the armed struggle before 94, before democracy, and that in a sense one can't take these things to heart. They are just songs. And I think someone said there's nothing wrong with the song.
The tragic death of Judge Steenkamp shortly after this episode was recorded is a great shock to friends and colleagues and an irreparable loss to the South African justice system. Now, looking to the future, LawPod UK has taken a close interest in the impact of artificial intelligence, not just on the practice of law or even the ethics of driverless cars and autonomous weaponry and so on. We've delved deep into the law as it exists, and we've interrogated its capacity for operation in a world where algorithms are taking over all the transactions. I asked barrister and tech expert Jacob Turner whether artificial intelligence, and more importantly, general artificial intelligence,
is an entirely new phenomenon to the law. Here's a clip of our conversation from episode 71 of LawPod UK.
You look both at legislation and common law as all elements of both for their suitability or adaptability to this new phenomenon. Let's just go to common law and its roots in ancient duties and breaches of duty. Do you see any potential for negligence or nuisance actions in the regulation of artificial intelligence?
In the short term, we will have to rely, in the absence of any more defined laws which are specifically tailored to artificial intelligence, on the law as it currently exists. And as you quite correctly identify, laws such as negligence and nuisance will inevitably, I think, be applied to artificial intelligence. The difficulty in the longer term, from a regulatory standpoint, of simply using the common law to regulate is that the common law develops by cases. It doesn't develop with any distinct methodology. It doesn't necessarily have a plan of development. And there's the old adage, which remains true, that hard cases make bad law. So we may well see a series of test cases that create rules in the common law with regards to how AI is to be dealt with, but they may go in multiple different directions, and the judges deciding those cases, although no doubt very expert and no doubt used to dealing with complex technologies, will not necessarily be able to take into account the multifarious different issues and matters of societal importance that is required when creating a holistic system of regulation for a new technology. So it certainly is possible, and indeed is likely in the short term, that there will be common law precedents developed with regards to artificial intelligence. The difficulty is that this will lead to uncertainty, and it may well lead to contradictions between different uses and different formats of artificial intelligence, which is both harmful to the companies developing the artificial intelligence and, I think, ultimately harmful to wider society as well, which will not be able to have the type of democratic input into developing the rules that would come if they were to be developed using another mechanism.
For those interested in AI, episode number 40 remains amongst our most popular ever. In that edition, I joined two specialists from the University of Pennsylvania to speculate on how algorithms and artificial intelligence will impact on regulation and adjudication now and in the future. If you want to see the links to the episodes I've discussed, just have a look at our post on the UK Human Rights blog, where Emma Louise Fenelon sets out all the relevant information. We have a great lineup of guests for LawPod UK in the autumn, but in the meantime, happy summer holidays to all of our listeners.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.